Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-1015, National Treasury Employees Union, a petitioner versus Federal Labor Relations Authority. Mr. Hennepel for the petitioner, Mr. Blanford for the respondent.
Good morning. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The Federal Labor Relations Authority wrongly held that three proposals relating to Customs and Border Protection's grooming standards policy, first, affected the exercise of management's right to determine its internal security practices, and second, were not appropriate arrangements for the exercise of such rights for employees adversely affected. First, on the management right to determine internal security, there are three reasons why the authority was wrong when it found a reasonable connection or a link between these new grooming standards policies and CBP's internal security goal of making sure that its officers are readily identifiable as law enforcement officials. First, it's just not a logical or a rational conclusion. It's the full uniform, the full official CBP uniform that includes the unique dark blue clothing with all of its accessories, the emblems, the nameplates, a badge, the very conspicuous display of a firearm that immediately identifies the officer to members of the traveling public. The grooming standards, including whether the officer has a neatly trimmed beard, is just not logically related to officer identification.
But the union does agree that the uniform itself falls in that category.
Yes, indeed, we do.
So why aren't the grooming standards just part of that? I mean, isn't that just a matter of degree?
Not in our view, and actually the authority's case law recognizes a difference between grooming standards and the uniform. It was undisputed, really, that CBP had the burden to come in and demonstrate the link between these grooming standards and officer identification. And the FLRA's decision on cargo shorts, I would say, is particularly relevant because CBP made exactly the same claim of officer identifiability that it makes here. There, the authority held that CBP had to come in and had the burden to show why officers in the work locations who were not allowed to wear the cargo shorts were somehow more identifiable as officers than those in locations who were allowed to wear the shorts. And here, where these grooming standards had been the previous grooming standards had been in effect for more than 20 years, as the record shows, including the wearing of beards for 20 years, the authority should have held CBP to the same burden to put evidence into the record that 20-year practice had in any way impeded its goal of officer identification. And third, and this goes
Isn't there
to
additional goal here.
I'm sorry.
Wasn't there an additional goal about effectiveness and altercations or something of that sort?
Well, that goes to not that I'm aware of. That flows from the goal of ready officer identification, and of course, in order to, I think that the agency referred to officer identification or officer presence as the first step in the use of force continuum. In other words, yes. when you're identified to the traveling public, that immediately means that you may have to use less force. That's the first step, and the individual is more likely.
It's sort of a commonplace of popular culture, if you will, that Secret Service agents, FBI agents, and so on, are cut from a mold that makes them almost indistinguishable in a way that beards would defeat. And I gather that something of that nature is what the service is shooting for here, the patrol says.
It may be. It may well be. And in fact, the only evidence that the agency put into the record were examples of grooming standards policies that had been adopted by other agencies, law enforcement agencies, or military units, including the Marine Corps.
That's pretty persuasive, isn't it?
Well, respectfully, no, because those models, and on their face, seem to have been adopted for other reasons than officer identification. And when Your Honor refers to cut from the same mold, for example, the Marine Corps policy refers to team cohesion. So there's a sort of an esprit de corps that I think those grooming standards were adopted in part to further. The National Park Service policy is an example, where it's the park ranger who, that uniform, that grooming standard is a means of furthering that esprit de corps. So in the case of the bargaining example, and let me just say that the cases that we cited where the authority had ruled on proposals that are really striking in their almost identical nature to the proposals that we put in here in the 1982 INS case and the 1988 Border Patrol Council case. That's really authority that's directly on point, and the authority didn't explain in any way why it was departing from that precedent. Now, I do want to just get to the question of appropriate arrangements, our second argument. We also believe that the authority incorrectly concluded that these three proposals were not appropriate arrangements. The analysis is set out and firmly established by the Kang case, the Kansas Air National Guard case. And it's got to be a very objective consideration of five specific factors that focus on the proposal's benefits to employees against any burden on the agency in exercising its management rights. And this is really the very point of the court's decisions in NTEU 1 and NTEU 2, both involving the same parties. In our view, the authority made exactly the same mistake here that it made in NTEU 1 and NTEU 2. It did not ground its decision on the record. First, as to the proposal allowing beards, the authority found that the wearing of a neatly trimmed beard could conceivably preclude CBP from requiring the use of respirators in an emergency situation. Now, in its brief, the authority concedes that it didn't rely on any empirical evidence in reaching that conclusion. And that's because CBP didn't submit any evidence other than this completely unsupported statement, and I refer the court to page 327 of the joint appendix, because that's the sum total. That one paragraph there referring to respirators. Now,
and what does it say?
It says that the agency has a confined space entry program, and that the use of a respirator is indicated in that sort of a situation. But they submitted no evidence that they had ever adopted such a program, had ever issued any respirators, and to the contrary, the union submitted considerable evidence, including the statement of a port director, that CBP had never established any program requiring the use of respirators, never issued any respirators.
What about the emails at email at 284? Which seems to be, pardon me, somebody responding to Dave Nishinaka's email. This is on behalf of the union, I believe, right?
Yes, and I think that the name of the person is Vera Adams.
Yeah.
And she is the port director. Okay. She's a supervisor.
And she says, this sounds exactly like what the confined space program is meant to address.
Meant to address, but never issued, never established, no evidence of any.
You say there is no such program?
There is never any. She said there's a confined space entry program, but never any evidence of what type of respirator had been issued, if at all, much less one that would not properly fit over a neatly trimmed beard.
Well, here's at 327, to which you referred us. pardon me. The agency says, not the authority, but the employer agency says, facial hair limits management's ability to assign this work as facial hair interferes with the wearing of this equipment, referring back to the masks in the earlier in the paragraph.
It refers to a dry mask, mm-hmm. but again, no evidence of the scope of that program, any documentation.
Why would the scope of it matter?
Well, for example, the officers that we submitted evidence from said unanimously that they had never seen any such mask. There were no masks available at any...
But the 327 says it's the employer's goal to deliver this training to all employees. So apparently at this point it's delivered it to some or none.
None, according to the evidence that we submitted. Mm-hmm. And it's just not...
you didn't submit evidence of none. You submitted evidence that no one you asked knew anything about it.
Well, but I mean,
you couldn't prove the negative.
It's true. But we did, we submitted evidence from 10 ports that, you know, big, huge numbers of employees. So, it's one thing to say that you have such a program, but or that you have a goal of you know, instituting a respirator program. But if the agency's never taken any real steps to implement it, it's hardly fair to speculate in the bargaining context that's going to be interfered with.
So if it's their goal but they haven't done it, does that reflect back on appropriate arrangement?
We would say so, because if
there's a balancing there?
It's a balancing, and if you look at the burden to the agency, if they haven't implemented any program, it's not going to be a burden on that unimplemented program to allow the wearing of neatly trimmed beards. If and when they do establish such a program, then that might be an appropriate time to look at the issue again. And when they go to implement the program, then we would have an opportunity to submit a proposal in response to that.
Okay. I just have one question.
Sure.
Related to the earlier issue, which is your proposals 2 and 4.
Yes.
You have referred several times to neatly trimmed beards. But the language here says contemporary grooming styles, provided the style does not create a health or safety hazard. And that seems to me to cover a lot more territory than neatly trimmed beards.
It could indeed, but again, that proposal has a limitation built into it, that it wouldn't interfere with any operational needs. It wouldn't interfere with any concerns arising from health and safety. And it does, as you say, cover conceivably a broader scope than beards. But the beard proposal, does focus specifically on facial hair. Okay, I see my time has expired.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Henry. We'll give you a minute for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. With respect to the first part of the authority's decision, the determination that the agency's grooming standards practices are matters of internal security, the authority properly determined that the agency had established a link between the grooming standards and internal security matters, namely the protection of its personnel, property, and operations. Because the grooming standards aid in the ready identification of its employees as federal law enforcement officers. Didn't say it's a necessary condition, but it aids, it's part of the package. Judge Brown, I think, had the authority's position correct and the employer agency's position correct that the ready identification doesn't come from just the uniform or the uniform and its accessories or just the grooming standards. It's the whole package. It's a way that the public has come to expect law enforcement officers to look like. They expect them to look as cops do. The agency's position and what the authority found, it's a very common sense sort of proposition. And it is supported by record evidence, namely practices of a wide variety of law enforcement agencies.
So I mean, those are the other policies? Those are all of the other policies that are in the record?
They're in the record.
Is there any indication that the authority relied on those policies?
They are not explicitly referred to within the authority's decision.
They're not
but
referred
they are,
to
But they are
all.
Part of the record. Excuse me, Your Honor.
But they're not referred to. We can't tell from the authority's decision whether those policies, whether the authority relied on them, correct?
Not explicitly, okay. But it's well established that in an administrative decision, every piece of evidence.
Well, how do we know? I mean, if an agency is required to rely on record evidence for a decision, which is the case here, correct?
Correct.
How do we know that it did if it didn't tell us that?
Well,
we can't look at the record and say, you know, the question is, what did the agency do, not what do we think it did?
Well, you know, the test is whether or not the reviewing court can reasonably discern the path that the administrative agency took, the authority here.
I think that goes to the reasoning. I don't think it goes to the question of whether a decision is supported by evidence, record evidence. And if the agency doesn't say it relied on a piece of evidence, how do we know it did?
Well, I think you can reasonably discern that the question of identification here and how it engenders respect and confidence from the public, it's common sense, I think, that they would have looked at the evidence in the record.
I can use common sense, so I'll use that here. Let me ask you a second question. Do we know from the record whether all of these policies that are in the record, do we know whether they were considered appropriate arrangements and maybe subject to negotiation or not?
I'm not sure.
We don't know, right?
As to whether the policies of the other federal
agencies. Other agencies, right.
That are in the record, whether or not those policies were negotiated.
I mean, suppose all of those were negotiated.
Well, even if they were, I mean, we don't know whether they were negotiated, what parts of them were negotiated, if they were negotiated at all.
Right.
What they establish is that these kinds of grooming standards are universally recognized as appropriate for law enforcement officers.
But if all of those other agencies negotiated them, how does that help your case?
I don't think it affects our case at all.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And a number of the agencies, such as the Secret Service, of course, aren't unionized at all, so those policies couldn't have been negotiated.
Well, do we know that from the record?
Not precisely, but certainly the authority has noticed that uniformed officers of the Secret Service are not subject to the statute.
Are all of the policies from agencies that are not subject to collective bargaining?
No, Your Honor. The National Park Service is there. They are certainly covered. That's right.
And you don't know whether those were negotiated or not?
No, the record doesn't indicate whether they were the product of negotiations or unilateral operations or some combination thereof. Uh-huh. With respect to appropriate arrangements, the second part where the authority found that these matters are not appropriate arrangements, the authority reasonably applied the Kang test. This court's very familiar with the Kang test. It has approved the Kang test. In fact, the Kang test has its origin in a decision of this court. In each case...
We're not talking about the first element of the Kang test, right? Don't you agree that the union... Doesn't the authority agree that the union sustained its burden on that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The first step of the Kang test is the union's burden, correct?
That's right, too.
Yeah. And didn't I read your brief as saying that you weren't contesting that? You were focusing on the second step?
That's right. The union has identified the benefit to the employees of their proposals, namely that the proposals
permit... The only question here is whether there's evidence... We're only looking at the second step, right? For purposes of this appeal.
It's not contested that the proposals benefit the employees by giving them personal discretion,
right.
Of course.
Okay.
So the question is, did the authority properly apply the Kang test and balance the benefits and burdens of the of the proposals. And in each case, the authority looked at the burden that the proposal would place on the agency's ability to exercise its management right. And in each case, it found that the significant burden on the agency outweighed the benefit to the policy.
How can they, let's set aside the question of evidence that you and I were just talking about. Two of the proposals, number 4 and number 6, both have provisions that make clear they wouldn't apply if they interfered with the agency's management objectives.
No, Your Honor, what they said they wouldn't interfere with, I don't have the exact language. But the question
one of them
is,
says, here, number 6 says they can have facial hair unless they're required to use a respirator. So 6 clearly exempts your, I mean, even if there is a respirator policy, 6 would not interfere with that.
It does, it interferes with the agency's determination that all its employees have to be able to use a respirator if the need arises. That's the important thing about that. It's not that under the union's proposal, if you had, you could have some with beard, some without, and then that would interfere with the agency's right to require all its employees, all of these employees, to use respirators when necessary in an emergency. That's what the agency's policy is intended to do, to give them the latitude to prepare for emergency situations. And the union's proposal, which would permit beards, interferes with that, and interferes with it significantly.
What do we know about that policy and whether it's been implemented? Or we have a lot of evidence of union members who've never heard of it.
Right, we don't know. And, of course, the record here is a number of years old. What the current policy is, there's nothing in the record, and I don't know, maybe.
Well, I realize we always deal with the record as of when it was compiled. What does it show about the existence of this policy or goal or what have you?
Well, the record certainly shows that it was a goal, whether or not they had implemented a specific policy with respect to respirators, but it certainly is a goal of the agency to permit, to allow for the use of respirators whenever respirators became necessary. And I think, and that certainly is an exercise of its rights to determine its internal security, probably other rights as well. And the whole point of the agency's position is, as I say, to prepare for emergency situations. And that's part of the mission of the agency, to protect our borders, protect the public from terrorists and other sorts of incidents.
Well, we have these snippets of evidence from union members saying this is a big port, you know, LA or what have you. We don't have any respirators. We've never been asked to use respirators. And when somebody has to use a respirator or enter a confined space, there's a crew that we call that's trained to do that. They're not employees of the same agency.
But as I say, the point is not necessarily what's been done, but the agency has the right to prepare for future contingencies. And the union's proposal takes that ability away from them by creating perhaps a class of employees who, as a matter of fact, could not use respirators when respirators.
Is there anything other than this sentence of 327 saying it is CBP's goal?
Other than the email exchanges, which indicated that respirators were obviously a topic of management discussion, and
can you point me to that?
Well, but you and Mr. Hannipal, I believe, were discussing there's discussion. This was on Appendix 284.
284.
Well, talks about what has to be done before employees can wear N95 respirators.
Where on 284?
the very bottom. Ornel Castro. I mean, it only indicates that there's discussion of...
Who is Cornelia Castro?
It appears that he or she is an agency official.
And is this a response to the inquiry from Dave Nishinaka? It appears to be. It's under reply separator. Unless someone's cut and pasted this, it surely looks that way.
I mean, this is the record we have, and I say all it shows is it doesn't show that there was a. All it shows is that the use of respirators was a matter which the agency was discussing. So it's not that that this was something created out of whole cloth.
What would Appendix D in 29 CFR 1910 show us?
Your Honor, I don't know.
What?
They apparently are OSHA regulations. Your Honor, my time has expired.
What?
Well, no, we're not through.
Yeah.
if you are talking about disposable N95 respirators for voluntary use, are we talking about that?
The union's. I mean, I'm
not sure whether the record is completely deficient in this respect, or whether you just don't retain an adequate command of it. But I haven't found anything other than these pages either.
That's what's here. But as I say, the agency's point and the authority's point is not that respirators have been used often. The point is that in order to prepare for emergency situations, the agency's determined that employees have to be able to use respirators if necessary.
And there should be somewhere an evidence of that, some directive, some determination, so the employees are aware of it. All we've got is emails from employees saying, never heard of it, or one saying, sounds like that program. That's it.
Well, as I say, that's not in the record, and I'm not sure it's necessary, because the importance of the management right is for the agency to be able to make determinations with respect to internal security.
Well,
and they've made the determination.
But if they said here, we have adopted this program. It's being implemented slowly. It's our goal to have everyone go through this training. We'd be that much ahead of where we are, where we've got a very vague statement and no indication that anything's been done to implement it.
Again, the record is what it is, but the reason the proposal interferes with the agency's right is it prevents it from requiring respirators when it becomes necessary.
So what if they had said, we don't have any respirators, and we don't have any intention of acquiring respirators, but in an emergency we might have to do that, so we want everyone to be prepared by having been clean-shaven?
Well, that's an extreme case, but it still would be an exercise of its right to determine internal security. The question is whether or not that would affect the balancing in an appropriate arrangements case.
Right.
And we don't have that.
In order to do that balancing, I would think you would need sufficient information about where the agency is on this. It's their goal, but are they going to be doing it any time soon or not? We don't know.
Well, that's the point is they still... The agency made.
This is our goal, and we're going to be implementing it starting in 18 months.
Right. That's
then. Then to allow the employees to have their way for 18 months wouldn't burden the agency at all.
Well, unless the agency determined because of emergency, because of changing circumstances,
all they've done is say we're getting started in 18 months. We'd like everyone to start shaving now to get in practice.
That certainly is a different situation, and perhaps under those circumstances, if the proposal was narrowly tailored to, well, for the next 18 months, or if the proposal was until the respirator program is implemented, but the proposal isn't tailored that way. The proposal simply permits beards.
But you assumed it was narrowly tailored.
We assumed that.
That's not an issue here. further questions?
Yeah. I want to ask you about this case that counsel mentioned. It's American Federation of Government Employees versus FLRA. It's an 82 case.
That's right.
All these cases have the same name, but this one's 82 involving the INS, right?
That's correct.
So how do you distinguish that case from this one?
Because that case, a number of reasons. First of all, that case was not an internal security case. It was a case that was determined under a different management right, namely the
But it was decided as an appropriate arrangement case.
But it was
a... It was still a management right. It was just... Wasn't it decided? It says... They said... The union said its policy was an appropriate arrangement under 7106B3. Isn't that the same issue here?
Yes, except... Okay. 1982 is pre-Kang, and the test and the analysis that the authority applied for appropriate arrangements was completely different at that time. We use the Kang test.
You what?
We say now that the Kang test is applied, and that's how we analyze these. Also, the factual situation is different. It's a different related agency, but a different agency, different context, different mission.
Wait a minute. You're not seriously saying that it's not controlling because it's a different agency.
But
the question is there a principle of law in the decision that applies?
No, I don't believe there is a principle of law that applies because...
Generally? Wait a minute. You said the case is not controlling because it's a different agency.
No, it doesn't control because... It was a different legal analysis, a different test, different standards that the authority applied in 1982 than the way the case law has evolved.
Well, what about this language from it? It says, okay, I take your point that it's pre-Kang, but it says, this is what the authority says. It says, the union's proposal expressly incorporates the INS's objective by saying that its proposed grooming standard would not impede ready recognition. So, and that's true of two of the three of these proposals.
But the record was different, the mission was different, and the test that the authority applies for internal security does not look to whether or not...
I wasn't asking you the internal security question. I was asking you the appropriate arrangements question. That's what we've been talking about for the past 10 minutes.
Right. Okay. And under
that... And this comes up under exactly the same statutory provision. Now, I take your point that it's pre-Kang. I have to think about that. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I just have
what's your response to the fact that this case you rely on is pre-Kang?
Well, actually, the 1988 case in Border Patrol Council that we cited.
Stick with this one though.
Well, I'm just saying that the 1988 case confirmed the 1982 case in its entirety. So that was post-Kang.
How did it do that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
How did it confirm it in its entirety?
It relied on, it was very similar proposal
language.
This is an
88 case, you said?
Yes, the Border Patrol Council case that we cited, and I think we chiefly relied on that. It adopted the same holding that the 1982 INS case had, and of course that was post-Kang.
Didn't it apply the Kang analysis?
It did not apply the specific Kang analysis.
Even though it was post-Kang?
Apparently the authority saw no need to apply the Kang analysis because it had ruled on almost the identical proposal language in 1982. And I would just point out that there's a factual determination that's made there about officer identification and grooming standards. And the nub of that factual determination, as Judge Tatel points out, is exactly the same as the proposal language here. So,
is there a difference between this means of performing work standard and the internal security?
There is generically, but as Judge Tatel points out, the appropriate arrangement determination is the same.
It'd be the same.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Case number 07-5345, Heartland Regional Medical Center Appellant